From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, what to do about hate speech. On campuses throughout the country and in other settings, there have been these efforts by some to censor speech that's hateful and traumatizing. But Nadine Strossen says that's not the way you stop it. Strossen is the former president of the National ACLU, and she'll join us to argue why banning ugly speech doesn't work. In fact, she says it just makes things worse. After this.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Nadine Strossen gets it when people are hurt by offensive language. She knows words can be powerful and can cause harm. In some cases, they can cause direct harm, drive people to actual physical violence. But one of the messages in her new book is that people need to get a thicker skin. Strossen used to be the national president of the American Civil Liberties Union, and free speech is a big deal for her. And she's not saying to the victims of bigotry and discrimination, suck it up. And she's not in any way blaming them for the hateful speech directed at them. Strossen actually thinks the growing number of young, outraged social justice activists is a good thing. She just wants them to resist this impulse to try and censor their critics or shout people down or ban them from their college campus. There are, she says, other, better, more effective ways of fighting back. Her book is called Hate, and the subtitle makes her larger point, why we should resist hate with free speech, not censorship. Strossen is a scholar of constitutional law and civil liberties, a professor at New York Law School. She joined us from the studios of NPR in New York. You had come to this point a few years ago where you had stopped actually writing about hate speech, stopped accepting invitations to talk about it, and you kind of figured you had nothing new to say, but then something started to change a few years ago. What did you start to see that made you think, gosh, maybe I need to jump back in here?
Starting a few years ago, Doug, we saw, to me, a wonderful resurgence of campus activism in support of human rights and equal justice for all. I say, to me, that was wonderful because way back in the day, in the late 60s and early 70s, when I was a student, I was a campus activist in support of those causes. And in the intervening decades, students had been relatively apathetic about politics. So this was a wonderful development. But the downside of it was we saw too many students who were crusading for social justice begin to assert that freedom of speech was their enemy, rather than what I am absolutely convinced it is, a time-tested and essential ally. That was an argument I had been making throughout my adult lifetime, and yet I realized, based on not only anecdotal evidence but public opinion polls, especially of younger people and students, that I clearly, and others who took my position, had not been sufficiently persuasive. So there's no doubt that I undertook writing this book, especially in the hopes of persuading those who are dedicated to civil rights and liberty and diversity and equality and dignity and inclusivity, that I wanted to persuade them that robust freedom of speech is absolutely an essential prerequisite for the success of their very worthy causes.
Do you think one goes hand in hand with the other, that when there's an emergence of activism, there might be an inclination to be excessive about speech?
Yeah, you know, that's a very fair point, because I did allude to my own student days, and it is absolutely true that people who supported some of the substantive policy goals that I was supporting, namely ending the war in Vietnam, were much less supportive of what I would consider a robust freedom of speech. So when I was a student, many on the left who were also active in the anti-war cause wanted to suppress speakers on campus, you know, to disinvite them or shout them down if they were representing the government or the military services or were in any way supporting the war in Vietnam. And way back then, even though I opposed the war, I opposed censoring those who had a different view. So I think there's always been a split between those of us who take a more neutral view toward free speech and those of us who say other goals are so important that we would like to censor speech that is inconsistent with those goals.
We should also say you do not go around in your writing now or in the way you're speaking about this, demonizing young people, these so-called social justice warriors, because you understand where they're coming from. Say something about that for a moment, because you're not at all
doing please. That. Thank you so much for underscoring that, Doug. It's very, very important to me. I get so irritated when I hear what I think are unfair attacks on today's students for two reasons. Number one, I think the urge to suppress, in particular, hateful speech, racist and other discriminatory speech, comes from a noble place and perspective, and that is a firm commitment to equality and dignity and diversity and inclusivity. These are students who are on the vanguard of really transforming our country into living up to the Declaration of Independence ideal that we're all created equal. And that deserves nothing but praise and applause. Secondly, they are no different from any older or prior generation in having an inclination to suppress ideas they disagree with. Yeah. And let me cite to you, Doug, the most dramatic example of that. The ACLU had its most controversial case ever in 1977 to 78, when we came to the defense of the free speech rights of a group of neo-Nazis to demonstrate in Skokie, Illinois, a town that had a large population not only of Jewish people, but many of them were Holocaust survivors or closely related to Holocaust survivors. And even ACLU members, die-hard supporters of freedom of speech, who put their money on their line to buy their ACLU membership cards, they resigned in droves over that position. The ACLU lost 15% of our members. And I tell you, they were not college students. And so, you know, if even card-carrying ACLU members will turn in their cards in protest over defense of hate speech, that shows there's nothing so surprising about a substantial percentage of today's college students also thinking that hate speech should not be protected.
I wondered, I was really curious about the lessons you drew from that Skokie case. And maybe we should point out that you have an intimate relationship with this case, for sure, because of your father who barely escaped the Holocaust. How were you working that out in those days? It couldn't have been easy for you to work that through.
I have to tell you the truth. It actually was completely easy for me. And not that I don't understand the other perspectives on the issue. Before I answer, Doug, let me point out that perhaps even more dramatically than my father having been a Holocaust survivor, the head of the National ACLU at the time of the Skokie case was himself a Holocaust survivor. His name is Arye Nair. He went on from the ACLU to become the founding executive director of Human Rights Watch and then the head of the human rights programs for the Soros Foundation, Open Society Institute, a towering global leader on human rights. But Arye lost his extended family, were completely murdered by the Nazis. He and his immediate family escaped, but with great trauma to him. He actually lost his ability to speak for a couple of years. He was so deeply traumatized as a child. And I think for him also, it was easy. And he explains in the book the reason why. And Arye basically says, and he says it much more eloquently than I'll do now in my paraphrase, he says, "I love freedom of speech, but much as I love freedom of speech, I loathe the Nazis even more." So if I thought that censoring Nazi speech would have prevented their rise to power, I would have been all in favor of it. But the evidence is completely consistent, not only in the period leading to the rise of Nazis in Germany at the time, but in every country throughout history around the world to the present day. Well-intended as it may be, censoring hate speech actually does more harm than good, precisely for the causes of equality and justice for all. And that's why in the United States, throughout the 20th century civil rights movement, the NAACP, the American Jewish Committee, all of the civil rights organizations opposed censoring hate speech. Among other reasons, they realized that it was a tool, along with all censorship tools, that would be used disproportionately to silence their voices as members of minority groups advocating dissident causes.
When you look at the polling that concerns you about the way people regard freedom of speech now, explain what you think you might be seeing there. And what do you think, because this is something you mentioned in the book, what do people actually know about the First Amendment and how it works?
Too often we hear in terms of just the issue of what speech is protected and what is unprotected, we hear diametrically opposite pronouncements that have in common that they are completely false. Number one is you hear too many politicians and even lawyers make the statement, hate speech is not free speech, to suggest completely incorrectly that speech that has a hateful message is automatically unprotected by the First Amendment. Not true. On the other hand, you often hear people say hate speech is protected. And it's also not true because the correct answer is that in certain circumstances, in certain contexts, speech that has a hateful, discriminatory, stereotyped message may be suppressed, but never just because of dislike or loathing, indeed, of its viewpoint, but only if in a particular context that speech directly causes certain specific, imminent, serious harm. And the only way to prevent that harm is through punishing the speech. And the most dangerous hate speech, by definition, is the one that poses an imminent, direct, specific threat of serious harm. And it is already subject to punishment under our law. Maybe I could give two examples, Doug, of speech that does and does not satisfy that standard. And it comes from Charlottesville in August of 2017.
Right.
As the daughter of a Holocaust survivor, you can imagine how horrified I was to hear recordings of the demonstrators chanting, "You will not replace us. Jews will not replace us." It's a horrible message that even as I repeat it today sends chills down my spine. But the mere fact that I loathe that idea, and I'm absolutely convinced the overwhelming majority of Americans, people in this country, despise and disagree with that idea. That alone is not a justification for censoring it. Why not? Because in certain communities in the 1950s and 60s, pro-civil rights messages were equally loathed and despised. So we can never allow it to a majority to decide what ideas are favored or disfavored. We have to fight them in the marketplace of ideas.
But Nadine, I should point out,
sure.
So Heather Heyer was killed. A young woman was killed in the riot that ensued. And that makes mm-hmm. some people think, well, wait a minute. There was a direct, this constituted an quote unquote emergency case here. That in fact.
So you're getting to the second half
Go
of
ahead.
The
Sorry.
Analysis, yeah. Doug, which is exactly right. So I was going to start even before we get to Heather Heyer, that when those demonstrators armed themselves with lighted torches yeah. and firearms that they were brandishing and they're marching en masse, in that context, the expression, indeed I would say their mere presence, even if they didn't say anything, does pose a specific direct harm. The term that the law uses for it is a genuine threat
yeah.
when the speaker intends to instill and does instill in a reasonable person a fear that he or she is going to be subject to some kind of physical attack. It's not a subjective test, so it's not if a thin-skinned person feels yeah. threatened in some loose sense, but I have no doubt that a reasonable person in that circumstance would reasonably feel fear and intimidation, and that would be an infringement of our liberty and our freedom of speech. I mean, I'm pretty outspoken, I don't think I would dare to confront people that are brandishing torches and firearms en masse. So free speech is no longer, you can no longer answer speech with speech. That's a genuine threat
yeah.
and should be punished. Now, the Heather Heyer incident is even, I think, a clearer case where, first of all, mowing down somebody, with, mm-hmm. you know, just plowing into a crowd of people with a car is a crime. Now, so clearly the person who committed that act should be and is appropriately being prosecuted. The question you raise is the more difficult one,
yeah.
which is to what extent should we attribute responsibility for his violent act to speakers who instilled in him general racist ideas. Now, obviously, I'm drawing a distinction. If a speaker was somebody who gave him instructions, you should get yeah. into a car, that becomes a co-conspirator. The law sometimes uses the term provides material support for the crime itself. The fact that you're doing it through expression does not immunize the expression. But I think you were trying to make a more attenuated connection to speech that was advocating racist ideas that from which he took an inspiration to commit this violent act.
Yeah, how do you create? I mean, you say in the book that too much rhetoric equates hate speech with violent criminal mm-hmm. conduct. So when does it become causal? Can we ever
yeah.
identify that?
It's an excellent question and one that U.S. law struggled with for many, many decades. And ultimately, Supreme Court unanimously concluded in a 1969 case that was an ACLU case, the so-called Brandenburg case, that there has to be a very tight and direct causal connection between the speech and the conduct to constitute punishable incitement. The Supreme Court has said that mere advocacy of violence or illegal action is not enough to warrant punishment. Rather, the speaker has to intentionally incite imminent violence where the violence is, in fact, likely to occur imminently, such that no other intervention other than punishing the speaker, silencing the speaker, will be enough to prevent the violence. Before that, for many decades, we had a much looser test, which was called the bad tendency test. Anytime speech had a tendency, perhaps potentially at some time in the future, to lead to violent or illegal conduct, then the speaker could be punished. And it was under that loose test that we saw the punishment and incarceration of anti-war protesters, of political dissidents, of people who were advocating for social change, including Martin Luther King Jr. Why did he write his famous letter from a Birmingham jail? Why? Because the powers that be clearly saw his advocacy of desegregation and racial equality as threatening life as we know it. In the McCarthy era, people who simply were teaching from classic works of Marxist literature were criminally prosecuted and convicted, because if people believed those ideas, they might come to work to overthrow the government of the United States. So a looser connection between speech and potential negative conduct just gives the government too much license to suppress ideas it dislikes. So the potential harm becomes a pretext for suppressing disfavored ideas.
Nadine Strossen, her book is called Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
You hear stories on KUER. They make you think and laugh. Sometimes they frustrate you, and sometimes they even make you cry. When that happens, what's the first thing you want to do? Share the story, of course. And thankfully, local stories you hear on the air wind up at KUER.org. You'll find news, podcasts, and all the Radio West you want, plus community events. When you hear a story you love, spread the love at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. On college campuses throughout the country and in other settings, there have been these efforts by some to censor speech that is hateful and upsetting, even traumatizing. But Nadine Strossen says that is not the way you stop it. The way you stop it is through more free speech. Her book is called Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship. And she's joining us from the studios of NPR in New York. The justices on the Supreme Court are often split, as you point out in the book. But you say on this point, they've been pretty consistent in supporting the core freedom of speech principles.
I honestly cannot think of a single justice, at least since 1969, who has disagreed with the core free speech principles that I've been laying out. We've had an enormous ideological diversity of justices since then. So that shows why these principles have been described by the Supreme Court as the bedrock underlying our freedom of speech. It's often referred to as viewpoint neutrality. Government must remain neutral as to the viewpoint of speech. And if, but only if, speech, regardless of the viewpoint, directly causes certain concrete, tangible, imminent, serious, specific harms, can it be punished? The most recent example was a case just in 2017 called Mittal versus Tam. It was decided 8-0. At that point, Justice Gorsuch had been appointed, but he not early enough to participate. They agreed unanimously that a hate speech law that was embedded in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Code was unconstitutional. It basically said that the government could deny trade name, trademark protection to any phrase that was deemed to be disparaging on the basis of race, ethnicity, and so forth. Interestingly enough, the ethnic slur at issue, which was the slants, of course, a traditional derogatory term for people of Asian origin, it was not used in the case by a hate monger. To the contrary, it was used by an Asian American dance rock band and its leader, Simon Tam, who are full-time crusaders against racism and for empowerment of Asian Americans in particular. And they were seeking to reclaim the term, to diffuse it of its traditional stigmatizing meaning and infuse it with their own sense of pride and empowerment. So when the government denied them the opportunity to do that, it was denying their equality as well as their liberty. But fortunately, the Supreme Court unanimously restored both.
We should point out that, as you mentioned in the book, quote unquote, hate speech is not actually a legal term of art.
Thank you so much for using those quotation marks, as I do throughout the
book.
A number of experts do that to remind folks that it is not a legal term of art. The Supreme Court never has defined a category of speech based on its message or its content, labeled it hate speech, and said for that reason alone it's unprotected by the First Amendment. And that's to be distinguished from the prime example of speech where the Supreme Court has done that, which is obscenity. Obscenity is a constitutional law term of art. The Supreme Court has applied that label to a certain category of sexually oriented expression, and it is automatically excluded from the First Amendment. But there is no content-based exclusion of speech with a hateful message. That said, speech with a hateful message, as well as speech with any other message, may and should be punished if it constitutes a type of speech that, in context, poses a serious and direct harm. Let me give you one case from the Supreme Court in which the intentional incitement standard was satisfied. It involved a group of young African-American men in Wisconsin who had just watched the movie Mississippi Burning, a vivid account of the horrific brutality and violence and torture even of African-Americans and civil rights supporters in Mississippi. And they were so upset when they were watching this movie, in particular a scene where a young black boy was praying and then he gets beaten up and killed. And one of the African-American young men named Todd Mitchell says to his friends, you know, do you feel all hepped up to move on some white people? And they're standing on the street and there's a young white boy on the other side of the street. And Todd says, you know, there's a white boy, go get him. And that they did attack him and beat him into unconsciousness. That clearly would satisfy the standard of intentional incitement.
I want to step outside of the United States for a moment here, because one of the things you write about in the book is that one of the missions of the book is to refute this idea that the U.S. should follow the lead of other countries in adopting this rather broad concept of hate speech. And I was going through the list of some of the actions going on in different countries related to speech. 2017, two British street preachers convicted of preaching from the Bible because it was deemed insulting to LGBT persons and Muslims. There was a case, and there's a lot of them here. Also in Great Britain, a British church was sanctioned for displaying a sign that said, if you think there is no God, you better be right. And there were flames in that sign. There was a Danish historian convicted for saying during an interview that there was a high crime rate in areas with high Muslim populations, which may be wrong and may be offensive, but this was a crime here. Talk about the difference between the laws in the United States related to speech and what you're seeing elsewhere and your concerns that the United States may lean a bit towards some of these other laws going on in the world?
The other countries have basically continued to adhere to the so-called bad tendency test. And under that test, saying anything that disparages on enumerated bases, including race, religion, gender, and so forth, may be punished on the theory that it may lead to some harm. It may lead to discriminatory attitudes, which may lead to discriminatory actions. It may cause an adverse emotional impact on the part of people who are disparaged by the speech. And I don't mean to minimize the offense and the potential damage that the immediate offense and adverse emotional impact that can be incurred from hearing yourself or people like you disparaged and degraded, nor do I mean to say that there is no potential connection between hearing these discriminatory ideas and discriminatory or violent conduct. But I am concerned about looking at all of the consequences that it may actually do more harm than good, including to the causes of equality and diversity and inclusivity, to give the government this vast power, which is so sweeping and so subjective because, you know, what one person considers to be disparaging or demeaning speech to somebody else is empowering and uplifting. Just think of the example of Simon Tam. For him, the slants was a term that showed the strength and the power and the pride in his racial heritage. You give the example of the Bible. Obviously, people who believe sincerely that homosexual conduct is a sin, for them to be trying to persuade people not to engage in that conduct comes from a loving motive, right? They're trying to preserve you, your soul, from eternal damnation. You may strongly disagree with them. You may completely reject those beliefs. But I think you would have to accept that it's really unfair to call that hate speech, right? It's yeah. For them, it's the opposite. They, and many of my Christian friends say, hate the sin, but love the sinner. And, you know, the ultimate irony is when these laws are used against the speech of members of the very minority groups and champions of their rights that are supposed to be protected under law. Other examples of what one person considers to be hate speech, somebody else considers to be loving speech. There have been a couple examples recently where the American flag was attacked as hate speech. In one case where school students weren't allowed to wear it in a high school on Cinco de Mayo because that was seen as disparaging Hispanic Americans, Latino Americans. And at a college in California, university in California, the heads of the student government organizations said, well, the American flag has been a symbol of colonialism and imperialism, so we're not going to display the flag in our offices because that connotes a message of hate. To take a completely opposite example, there are many people in this country who believe that burning or otherwise, quote, desecrating the U.S. flag in political protest, that is a form of hate. Hate speech. So is attacking the flag hate speech? Is displaying the flag hate speech? It depends who you ask. And once we have that subjectivity, whether it's going to be punished or not rests in the hands of those with political power that inherently endangers any minority group or any minority political perspective.
You mentioned before that there is not any evidence that hateful speech is harmful enough to warrant banning it, which leads, of course, to the question, is there any evidence that hate speech bans or censorship actually reduce violence or other harms? And you say no, that. But you say this, even if the answer to those previous questions were yes, that it is materially harmful, you say it would that it would reduce violence and other emotional harms. There's still a question of whether or not it would be worth it because the costs would be so high. Damage, you say, to freedom of speech, damage to democratic legitimacy. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
I would never say that speech does not cause harm. It definitely does. But it has a different relationship to harm than other conduct. And I say other conduct advisedly because another myth or misconception about speech we often hear, speech is protected, conduct is not protected. Well, that's not a really helpful distinction because speech does involve conduct. Burning a flag is speech and it's also conduct. Wearing a black armband is speech, but it's also conduct. So the courts often use the term expressive conduct, which I think is a pretty good term to describe what's at issue. Expressive conduct doesn't directly and immediately cause harm of its own force. It requires the intermediating processing of the human brain. So let's take that old saw, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. That's clearly untrue. Words hurt constantly, right? All of us have been hurt by words. But the difference is that words hurt us only because of how we process them. And when our parents told us that old saying, it was to firm up our resolve to not let words hurt us, right? That person's insulting you. Don't give him or her the power or the satisfaction of actually being hurt. You know, you can dust off their comments. You can look down on them. And by saying all of this, I don't mean to say, we should blame the victim if somebody feels terribly insulted and emotionally and psychologically and physiologically distressed as a result of hate speech. I'm not going to blame that person, not at all. But I am going to quote the many psychologists and mental health experts and educational experts who say, there are ways that we can help you become resilient so that you are not subject to potential hurt by even hateful, derogatory speech, and so that you can steel yourself against it and rise above it. And certainly when we hear hateful speakers, 99.999% of us are not thereby, quote, inspired to jump in a car and plow down pro-civil rights demonstrators. No, most of us are motivated to go out and demonstrate against those racists in counter demonstrations and counter protests. So this year, even in Charlottesville itself, after those horrific events, there was just an eruption of what lawyers often call counter speech, countering the hateful messages that I think absolutely drowned out those hateful messages. And the denunciations came from across the political spectrum, from top government officials, from top military officials, and also at the grassroots level in communities around the country, there were spontaneous demonstrations. In fact, the one person who conspicuously did not satisfactorily denounce the hateful speech, namely Donald Trump, was himself so strongly criticized. Trump had two business counsels, CEOs of top companies, and they were so outraged that both of those counsels of business leaders disbanded. So, you know, far from causing people to adopt racist ideas and engage in racist actions, racist speech may actually well galvanize us to come together and mobilize against discrimination.
Early in the book, you quote Ruth Simmons, first African-American president of an Ivy League university. She was Brown's first female president. And she said that young people are not, or shouldn't be anyway, in college or on campus for comfort. Which gets us to this section of your book where you talk about the importance of self-restraint. And you talk about, for example, developing a thicker skin. Figuring out, as you say, how to be less sensitive to hate speech that targets us and more sensitive to hate speech that targets others, even though you acknowledge it's easier said than done. Talk a little bit about that. You're not asking young people to just get over it, but you are saying that developing a thicker skin is important.
And this is so important, Doug. I'm so glad that you refer to Ruth Simmons. I recognize that although I'm a Jew and a woman and for both reasons have been subject to hateful speech, that I'm basically a white, well-educated person with a great deal of privilege and power. And therefore, I think it's incredibly important that I quote other people who have had more experience with structural discrimination than I have. And the basic argument that comes from Obama and Simmons and Van Jones and other activists is that the only way that you can effectively advance the causes to which you are committed, including racial justice and other forms of social justice, is not through silencing those who disagree with you, but through confronting them. And they use the example of the 1960s civil rights movement because that's what those activists did. They went face to face with their antagonists and, you know, subjected themselves to vitriolic epithets and abuse. And sometimes they actually persuaded the people with whom they were engaging. But even when that didn't happen directly, that process persuaded others in the country who were observing this to have more respect and support and sympathy for the civil rights movement. So the question is, if you want to be effective in bringing this country closer to our founding ideals of liberty and justice for all, you're not going to do it through censorship. The only way that you're going to do it is through counter speech and through anti-discrimination laws and through anti-hate crime laws. And, you know, it comes back to why did I write this book? That's exactly the point that I'm making to the social justice warriors. If you want to be an effective one, please oppose censorship and don't let, you know, this is funny, I'm thinking of my college motto, which was, don't let the bastards get you down.
It seems like one of the things that some people may identify as different from, obviously different from the 1960s and the civil rights movement is we're now in the information age. But you point out that the double-edged sword of the internet, of course, is it does make it easier to be hateful, but it also makes it easier to respond to hate. And you mentioned this report from 2016, I think it was, about counter speech on Twitter. And it found that the most effective way of undermining it was not getting rid of it, not censoring hateful speech, but just allowing more counter speech by fighting it. That was the most, I think, according to the report, the most effective way of dealing with it.
And that's so interesting because not only does social media make it easier to engage in counter speech, but it also makes it easier to study counter speech and what methods are most effective. And some of the conclusions are not surprising. They coincide with common sense, but they're very interesting. So, for example, reaching out with humor and compassion are much more effective than stridently engaging in attacks. And there are two categories that I want to talk about of counter speech, Doug. One is when you're making a mass point to a mass audience, especially if we're talking internationally online. Not surprisingly, pictures are really important because they transcend language barriers. So there was an example of a Brazilian soccer player of African descent, very dark-skinned, and a racist meme that was used against him is to post an image of a monkey eating a banana. And I guess people would actually, racists would throw bananas onto the field when he was playing. And so the spontaneous counter-speech that erupted was for people around the world to post selfies of themselves eating bananas. Yeah. And I love that, you know, as the Jew, the daughter of a Holocaust survivor, I thought of, you know, everybody wearing gold stars rather than just Jews wearing gold stars. The other category of online counter speech, which quite frankly, I hadn't even thought of until I did the research for my book, there are a surprising number of people who are doing the incredibly generous, devoted, time-intense work of one-on-one engagement with racists and hate mongers, going online to seek them out, to engage with them, to reach out to them, to try to find out what is at the root of their hatred and to reach out. Not surprisingly, it doesn't work unless you do it in an empathetic, compassionate way. Again, not empathetic toward the idea, but toward them as people. And there have been incredibly inspiring examples of even leaders of hateful organizations have been won over, have been redeemed by these incredibly generous interceders.
Makes me think about something you write about, one remarkably simple technique, just a sincere apology, which it turns out receiving an apology, or I guess even offering one, has an actual physical effect on your body.
It just as, and I would never deny this, hearing hateful words can have not only an emotional and psychological impact, which is bad enough, but a physiological impact. So we shouldn't be surprised that positive speech can also have positive physiological impacts. And, you know, sometimes people could intentionally say something and that's hurtful and apologize for it. But often it's just insensitive, unthinking, unintentional, but still deeply hurtful words. If we just attack that person and call them a racist, that's not going to do any good. But if we reach out in a way and we'll accept their apology and use it as an opportunity for reconciliation, we shouldn't raise the temperature so much. Every time somebody says something that's an unintended slight, you should not even use the term hate speech, because that itself raises the conflict rather than reducing it. But I have to have one qualification here, Doug, which is it has to be a sincere apology.
Right.
If it's one that is forced because, you know, your campus bureaucrat instructs you that you must deliver it, evidence shows, not surprisingly, that it has no positive benefit either for the person who is giving it or for the person who's receiving it. If it were sincere and genuine, it would have benefits for both of them.
I wanted to have you say something finally about what I think might have been my favorite technique that you mentioned in terms of counter speech, and that's silence. You say that might be one of the most effective methods of counter speech.
It's so tempting to want to get out there on the hustings, raise a ruckus, try to shout them down, shut them down, censor them when we hate their ideas. But as morally satisfying as that might be, it may actually strategically not be the most effective technique in many situations. I think we have to make a case-by-case determination of what is the most effective response. But one of the organizations I admire a lot that does so much wonderful work in this area, the Southern Poverty Law Center, put out a guide for college students a little bit more than a year ago when there was evidence evidence that there would be big efforts by white supremacists, white nationalists to recruit on college campuses. And the SPLC said to students, you know, in many cases, silence may be the most effective response, because what the hate mongers are seeking to do is to draw attention to themselves. And unwittingly, by seeking to silence them or to disrupt them, you're drawing the media attention that they otherwise would not have. And with attention, they get a certain amount of sympathy. So maybe the best thing to do is just ignore them. If you want to express yourselves, go somewhere else, far away, a different part of campus, and have your own affirmative celebration of diversity and inclusivity. But don't play into their strategy of magnifying the attention, amplifying their message rather than suppressing it.
You started writing, talking about this because you were worried. Right now, are you optimistic or pessimistic, I guess, finally?
I'm congenitally an optimist, Doug, and I've lived a long time and it hasn't changed, no matter what the circumstances. I think there are so many wonderful people in this country, and we have a wonderful set of government institutions, so that there are always checks and balances, and the pendulum is always swinging, and there are course corrections. And I think the pendulum had swung too far in favor of censorship, but there have been many, many pushbacks, not only my own book, but other books, and even a couple of whole new organizations have been formed, including organizations that were generated by college students themselves spontaneously to support freedom of speech and intellectual diversity and civil discourse. We saw in the last elections the number of new candidates from both parties, that more than two parties who were running for office for the first time, including many women and members of minority groups and younger people. So that's exactly the right response, that we are all seeking to become more engaged to bring about the goals that we are championing, including freedom of expression and human rights.
Nadine Strossen. Her book is Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship. She joined us from the studios of NPR in New York. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.